Hello everyone, and welcome to episode 7 of The Edict. This week, we're serving up something for the newer members of the Pauper community. We'll be doing a survey of the different archetypes that exist in each style of play for Pauper. Due to the number of unique decks, this will have to be a two-part show. Today we are covering aggro and control. Next week we'll be going through midrange, combo, and tempo. So sit back, relax, as we bring you this week's Royal Decree. And we're here today talking about the different archetypes that are popular in the Pauper metagame. So today we're going to be covering control and aggro. So I'll start off with kind of talking a little bit about what control is to the Pauper format and why different archetypes are able to leverage these insane value engines to make those big endgame plays for their deck. So one of the most popular Tron archetypes we have are the Dinrovatron and the Marasatron. So these are using the Urzatron lands to basically tap three lands to make about 7 mana. That's how the lands work. If you have the mine, the tower, and the power plant, then they add up together to produce 7 mana total.
Yes, 1 plus 1 plus 1 equals 7.
That's so the Tron math.
The crazy thing about these Tron control lists is Tron naturally lends itself to, at bare minimum, mid-range to control, right? In other formats where Tron is present, like Modern, it plays much more akin to a mid-range than a control deck. It has plays that it can make to stop people in the early and middle game, and then has just a crazy high top end and just usually out top decks its opponent, just because it has so many huge creatures and things it can play. In Pauper, a simulacrum of that plays out with the Tron decks, right? You have Tron lists that have, you know, early low to the ground interaction in the form of removal, whether it's, you know, Lightning Bolt, Counterspell, any form of disruption at the lower end, and then at the top end you have giant cards which leverage both value and present tough to beat threats in the form of like Dinrovahar, Ulamog's Crusher, Rolling Thunder for just lethal potentially, depending on the list and how much mana you're making if the game goes late enough. It's not too unlikely to have a Tron deck at, you know, on turn, you know, 15, 16, whatever, you know, whenever super late into the game, making 30 mana a turn potentially with its Tron lens.
Yeah, and being able to dump that into those value engines like Cycling Ghostly Flicker like 15 times.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
It just lets you generate so much overwhelming value that it really puts most other decks out of the game entirely, compared to what the Tron deck can really do. Like, even other options in the control palette, like Blue-Black Control or Blue-Red Control, both of those kind of pale in comparison to what their top end looks like.
Yeah, the top end for Blue-Black Control is maybe Gurmag Angler or
Capsize 15 times.
Yeah, Capsize 15 times, or potentially they could play it, but it's just not as powerful as it would be in Dinrovatron, but they could also play Dinrovahar, but I don't really see a valid reason to play Dinrovahar if you aren't playing Tron lands.
No, it's not a good target for your flicker loop. Like, you're not usually running that type of setup in the U-Block.
They'd rather flicker Chittering Rats and whatnot.
That kind of thing, right? More lower to the ground plays.
The other thing about Tron, which makes it such an incredibly powerful control deck, is that naturally with the shell of Tron and Pauper, it allows decks that decide to use the Tron shell, it allows them to ignore a few of the deck building mantras and restrictions, which are universal to every other type of deck in Magic except for Tron, which is there's little downside to just jamming 4 to 5 colors in a Tron deck and then abusing things like Prismatic Lens and Prophetic Prism and Chromatic Sphere and Star. Abusing
the lands that do the same kind of stuff.
Yeah, abusing the artifacts and cards that transform colorless mana to colored mana. There's very low to no downside to be playing red cards, blue cards, black cards, and white cards and green cards in your Tron list because you don't have to care about the you know, classic rule of deck building, which is you can't play all the colors and you can't play every color. Well, Tron doesn't care. It's fucking Wooburg, man. It's Wooburg. That's what it is.
It generally gets to pick whatever are the best cards in any color, right? Like, well, Pulse of Morass is a really great card, right? It's just a really powerful card that does a lot of work for this type of deck. And, well, we're just going to play green to get it, right? Even if we're not playing much else in green, we're playing Fogs and that, basically. Or we'll go over to blue-black and we'll do Nova Horror, right? Or we'll go over to red and we'll pick up single drop removal for the Morassa style lists, right? Where it's...
It doesn't matter. The other thing, you know, when you're playing in a competitive aspect, when you're playing against Tron, it doesn't matter what Tron archetype you're playing against. All of them could have any number of circle protections in the board, right? Because splashing a single white mana is no big deal to them, you know? A Tron list can make, you know, can cast circle protection on turn two, or I'm sorry, on turn three, and not have to play a single white land to do it.
That's the dream for the Tron player, right? Is turn three, put all the Tron lands together, play a Prism, and you have three mana of with a color that you want, right?
Play a Prism, play a Muldrift, your pass.
There's even entire Tron archetypes like the Rustic Circle ones that are playing exactly that as their core plan.
Yeah, Rustic Circle.
It's not as popular an archetype because it loses to more things. It's not as generally good, but it does have some diehard pilots.
Yeah, if you wanna stomp your local paper pauper events, consider that deck because it's pretty brutal, especially in an unprepared meta if you learn how to pilot it pretty well. It's just in aggregate we don't see it showing up in tournament finishes and league results and challenge results and that type of thing.
The other half of the control pie for us is more focused a little bit more on the bigger mana strategies coming from blue black and from red and blue, right? While these strategies have options at the lower end of the spectrum on the meta with things like Is It Delver and blue black Delver and you know, blue-black reanimated, that kind of thing. These are the two very top-end focused control decks. And we haven't nearly been seeing as many of these in the meta lately. These could have kind of died out in favor of the Tron decks in a big way.
These decks function very similar to what a traditional or typical control deck would want to function as, right? You go, your best play is land, go, hold up a bunch of instants, right? Answer your opponent's threats for long enough, reach a point in the game where you have stabilized and you feel safe, deploy a threat that's hard for your opponent to deal with, finish the game with that threat while further delaying your opponent from dealing with it.
Yeah, it's the exact standard control draw-go type gameplay, right, where you're trying to play as few creatures as possible, you're trying to play as many broad answers to a variety of things.
Yeah.
Our control decks, especially the blue-black ones, get the luxury of playing one of the best tutors in the format, which is Mystical Tutor.
Mystical Teachings.
Mystical Teachings, yeah, sorry.
Mystical Tutor.
I've had my head up EDH for a while.
I see. That card's really good in EDH.
It sure
Mystical
is.
Mystical Tutor for Psychrift all day.
Yeah, so Mystical Teachings lets you search for an instant or a card with flash in your library for 4 mana. But it also has flashback for, I believe it's 6 and a black?
I believe it is 5 and a black. Let me check right now. It's
basically your big value engine that lets you shoot down a specific problem, right? You can pick all these small silver bullet answers at instant speed, and then you can then respond to things by, I'll mystical teachings at instant speed, and then I'll find my answer, and then I'll be able to deal with your whatever problem you're presenting.
Yeah,
me,
so. It is 5 and a black, by the way. Yeah, and the power from Mystical Teachings is that late enough in the game, you can potentially go in response to your thing, Mystical Teaching, you know, at the end of your turn, Mystical Teachings for an answer I'm trying to find, and cast it end of turn and untap. Right, so the power there is that the deck can function completely at instant speed, but they've fallen out of favor in the meta because Tron has But first off, Tron has a Tron. The Tron decks have an incredible matchup into the other control decks, right? Dinrova and Marasa Tron have incredibly good matchups into blue-black control, blue-black teachings, and pieces. And on top of that, the matchups that Tron beats with ease can give the other control deck some trouble. So it's basically them falling out of favor because, in terms of control deck, Tron, unfortunately, it's just better. It's just a better deck, right?
It does that type of activity, the control style of play, just better because it generates more mana. It can say, well, I just don't care about the CMC of my cards. They can be as high as I need them to be, and I will probably still be able to cast them.
Yeah, which is why you see the Tron lists playing cards like Prohibit, right? Where they don't, you know, kicking them for four mana isn't a problem, whereas, you know, the four mana answer suite in blue-black controller pieces might be Rewind, and the reason to play Rewind is, you know, it's a four mana counter, right, but it's free, right? But Tron just doesn't care. It just says, I'm going to play this card and not care whether it's 2-4, you know, 6 mana potentially, you know?
Because my four lands generate like 12 mana.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
So going back a bit towards Tron, let's talk about what kind of makes the different archetypes in Tron the definitive types that they are.
All right. So Dinrova Tron is specializing in blue black, right? As its main colors, using cards
blue black,
like,
or blue green.
Yeah, using cards like Forbidden Alchemy and Dinrova Horror at the top end to finish the game out, right? Forbidden Alchemy as just card advantage and draw power. And using cards like Dinrova Horror, which are just big, fat guys that threaten your opponent and make it so that, you know, they're bouncing and discarding creatures or potentially lands if you're that far ahead. I don't think I've ever discarded a land that was bounced by Dinrova Horror and then ended up winning that game.
Yeah, that's sort of what Dinrova's trying to do, is it's trying to not interact with your opponent so much as it's trying to just say, I will get to a point where I will get out of hand, and I just need to have enough fogs to get myself there, right? You burn your life total, and you burn your moments pieces to prevent your opponent from actually getting enough damage across to kill you, and stall the game for enough time to say, well, I've hit the point where I can flicker Dinrova Horror 15 times, and you have a board of, you know, maybe 5 creatures. Sorry. Like, that's it.
Kiss your lands goodbye. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Whereas Marasa Tron is more of an interactive deck. They're looking not to play as many fogs. They still play a moment's piece, but they're not looking to lean on that as their main game plan.
Yeah, it's
right?
Usually like 1 to 2 main board, I believe, with mm-hmm. maybe one in the side.
Yep, and they're looking to more use stuff like Flame Slash, Lightning Bolt, or an early Rolling Thunder to just trying to keep the board clear, attack your permanents and your threats in that way, rather than just letting you have them but fogging.
Play a more 1-for-1 style of a control deck where, you know, you trade threats and answers between each other, and eventually their plan is to pull ahead because they're making so much mana that...
Well, eventually they will assemble enough Tron lands that the game's over, right?
Yeah, the plan with Marasa Tron is, you know, I'm going to 1-for-1 you repeatedly, right? And eventually I'm going to be able to provide 4 answers at the same time when you can only provide 1 threat. And then eventually when it comes time, I'm going to be able to deploy 4 threats where you will only be able to provide 1 to 2 answers, right? And then I'm just going to outvalue you that way, right? When I'm going to be casting, you know, Pulse of Marasa, getting back Moldrifter, and then flickering Wall to get back Pulse of Marasa 2 times in a turn, and you can't stop that loop, I'm going to win the game, right?
Yeah, exactly. You sort of try and set up those value engines at some point in the game, and you sort of let that ride you to victory. So that's sort of your core difference between those two decks, is that what you're leaning on as your method of getting to late game, right? Whether it's fogs and a few counter spells, or whether or not you're trying to get in there and trade your removal for threats and stuff like that. The boards of the two decks they have a lot of similar cards, but they do have a fairly wide difference in what else they're running beyond that.
The other thing that comes into play when you're looking at the boards between the two decks is just player preference and also the wide array of cards that Tron has available to it, again, because of the lack of the color restriction. So,
yeah, teching your board is something that's very popular with a lot of Tron players, to kind of make it a little bit more specific and a little bit more targeted towards what they're looking to face. So you often see, you know, people will have like three or four flex slots in the deck that will vary a lot between different challenges, different leagues, different players, right? So that can kind of be sort of a mix and match component for the deck a lot of the time. In our other half of the in the control setup is the more standardized control lists. And the while blue-black control kind of leans on teachings or Forbidden Alchemy as its big draw engine, the other one we have that's sort of a bit more of an older list that people were playing around with, that they're sort of mumblings of it coming back.
Yeah, now that Fire Ice is legal, yeah, blue-red pieces of the puzzle. While this list used to run Pieces of the Puzzle, which is a sorcery spell for two and a blue, you look at the top five cards of your library, you put up to two instant or sorceries from that pile into your hand and put the rest into the graveyard. While it used to run that card as an engine, people found out that it was just better to just play pieceless pieces of the puzzle, if that makes sense. So you take the entire shell from Pieces of the Puzzle and you just cut the four pieces and you play something else.
Usually Fire and Ice or that kind of thing.
Yeah, there are mumblings of it coming back simply because Fire and Ice is legal now, which I definitely encourage. While it still was legal, it was a very formidable deck to play against before people realized that just Tron was 100% better in almost every single matchup.
But yeah, that's Tron for you. Yeah, we saw it, or a newer, updated version of it, show up in the challenge we covered in the last episode before the holidays. That was playing around with Fire and Ice, and it didn't do amazing, but it did put up a reasonable result in the challenge.
Which,
so,
in all honesty, for a non-Tron control list, that's a tongue twister. That's pretty much the best you're looking to do. It's pretty much what you should be aiming for. I'm not gonna lie, you know, I don't think unless we have a serious meta shift, I don't think you're gonna get to a point where you can have a blue-black control list or a blue-red pieces-esque control list that outperforms a Tron list in aggregate against the format, right?
Yeah, by and large, the Tron decks just have better matchups, they have better win percentages, you're doing just strictly better things 9 times out of 10. You may not be playing as efficiently as a Pieces deck or a blue-black control deck, but that's sort of not what Dendrovatron or Morassatron's really about. So following that, we can head over to the aggro corner.
Flipping the coin over, eh?
Mm-hmm. Right onto the other side of the clock.
Yeah, right. So in aggro, we have the two of the mainstays of the format for aggro decks, which is Stompy and Boggles, which go nowhere. They're always in the meta because they're very simplistic, streamlined decks that want to do one thing. Stompy wants to play creatures and turn them sideways at your face until you're dead. And Boggles wants to play a dude and put pants on the dude and turn the dude sideways until you're dead. So, aggro decks in this format are very powerful and well-positioned in the meta because when you have only one goal in mind when you're building or playing a deck, it becomes very easy to find the most efficient and best cards for that specific deck, right? Like, Stompy at this point is basically a solved archetype, right?
Yeah, it's sort of had a little bit of talk about maybe messing around with it a little bit recently, but by and large, I would say that Stompy is the 75 for it is almost...
You can go look at the challenge results and look at each individual Stompy list. Between each of the lists, there's maybe only 4 to 5 cards that are different, and most of those differences are, I'm playing one more copy of River Boa and he isn't, right? I'm playing two copies of a card that's not in the other lists, you know? Many of them have an extremely high percentage between the decks of just cards that are shared.
Yeah, it's not a list that has a lot of variation or a lot of tech choices like some other alternatives in the more meta.
Do I want to play Natural State? Or, damn it. I'm forgetting the card.
Lethal Sabotage?
Yeah, no, not that. I was, Never mind. I was gonna make a joke. It doesn't matter.
Gosh. Yeah. So basically, the upshot with a lot of these is that the core of these decks is it's been ironed out a long time ago, right? Like Slivers is another aggressive deck we have that has it's you play your 12 Lords and then you play some other good green and white stuff. Boggles, you play your Boggles and you play this selective number of enchantments like Rancor and
Rancor, Ethereal Armor, Ancestral Mask, Armadillo Cloak.
Yeah. Burn is play your bolts, play your things that are sort of bolts, and that's about it, right? Yeah.
Burn is mountain 3 until you're dead.
I would say burn in our format is a little bit more complex than it is in a lot of other formats.
Yeah, it's very closer to Legacy Burn rather than modern.
We don't quite have enough bolts to make it work.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
We haven't got any of those rare versions that are like, oh, it's 2 mana but it deals 8 or something ridiculous like that, right?
No, I don't want that card made. I don't want red deal 8 damage.
Well, technically, Rift, Flame Rift does that. 4 damage each player.
Oh, you stop.
Yo, you know me.
Interesting thing, you touched on Slivers there for a moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, let's get into Slivers a little
Slivers
bit.
Slivers is a very interesting deck to me because it's the only, unless you count Delver as a fairy tribal deck, which I don't, but some people do.
No, I don't think I would either.
Outside of Elves, Slivers is the only other tribal deck in the format.
Goblins.
Right?
Goblins also exists.
I mean, yes, but does it place?
It places a little bit. We had a Goblins list in the last challenge that got not a terrible position. It exists.
Fair enough, but I mean, I don't know. I like Slivers because, it's one of the few tribal decks in the format, and it's very streamlined in what it does. And, well, personally, it's the first deck. When I make a brew in Pauper, it's the first deck I test it against, right? Because Slivers, it just does its thing every game. It just plays Lords, and it plays Slivers, and it turns them sideways, right?
Yep, it's a very consistent type of deck that way.
And additionally, I've seen some. I've seen in paper at my LGS. There's a player that plays Slivers there, and they're not on the traditional green white version, either. They're on Abzan now, splashing black for Crypt Sliver. Crypt Sliver is black mana for a sliver that has all slivers have tap regenerate this creature, and coupled with Sentinel Sliver, which is the sliver that gives all other slivers vigilance, you can now have an endless army of vigilant attackers, and when your opponent attempts to block one and eat them, you just regenerate it.
Or removal or anything, right?
Yeah.
I can definitely, people who have been sort of playing around with the archetype a little bit in the last, couple months, we've seen a number of posts on Reddit about red-green slivers, and we've had people testing with Adventurous Impulse. We've had, I would say at this point, Lead the Stampede has basically been adopted into the list as a mainstay. Although I do see some people not playing it, but it's pretty common.
The player in question at my LGS does not play Lead the Stampede in their list.
I would imagine they have a hard time fitting it. It's sort of one of those things where it's based on your threat base, right? Like, how many free slots do you have once you hit your cap out on Lords, right?
Yeah, how many, and Lords, and then cards that work really well with the Lords, right? Because, you're going to play the 12 Lords, right? That's a given. But, you're probably going to also want 4 Sentinel Slivers in there because that's a really good card, along with, maybe 4 Sidewinder Slivers because that makes blocking impossible for your opponent, right? So, now you're...
Yeah, and your Plated Slivers.
Yeah. So now you're 24 cards deep already, and you don't even have lands,
Mm, man, exactly. So it's definitely a deck that has a lot of options that can kind of make it either better or worse, depending on how people play around with
it. For sure.
But we've seen that show up in a couple of events semi-recently. Like, we had a couple at the, what are they called, Rags to Riches.
Yep.
We see it in challenges semi-often, though it never usually places that well.
Right.
As for the rest, we have Stompy, Burn, Heroic, which we have yet to talk about, Boggles, and Slivers.
Yeah, Heroic is we haven't been seeing too much of it lately. It was like the new hotness for at least a little while. And it's just it's a mono white aggro deck based on cards from Theros block that have the Heroic mechanic, and cards like Chomino's Blessing, which is a complicated card, but basically it's an engine for the deck to constantly trigger Heroic and make it, and also advance its aggressive plan and nature of the deck. And it performs well, but once people, you know, it was very much, in my opinion, kind of flavor of the monthy. It was...
Yeah, it was flavor of the month, but you had a few people who were kind of diehards that picked it up and kept on running it and were pretty good with it. But one of the things I would say about Heroic is it's sort of backwards boggles, if that makes sense, where your enchantments aren't really doing anything beyond protecting your creatures, but the creatures, when you enchant them, do what your enchantments and boggles would do, where they, you know, they get pumped up and they get really big and that sort of thing, right? So it's sort of a reversal of that ideology, where your creatures aren't actually all that resilient. Like, it's a 1/2 that you can just throw a bolt at, but when you throw something on it, it gets significantly bigger, and the thing that you put on it protects it.
Yes, like, we have the technology. We can rebuild him.
Yeah, it's sort of an interesting archetype, because it gets to play a lot of cards that you really didn't see that much, and it sort of was one of the decks that sort of came out of nowhere, right? Where it was sort of, no one had ever heard of Heroic, and then in the next couple of days it was like Heroic was everywhere and everyone was talking about Heroic for about a week or two,
and then around a month passes and people are like, is anyone still playing Heroic? And someone's like, no, what's that?
Yeah, so it's sort of a fun deck, and it plays a lot of interesting cards. Like, there was the whole provoke thing that the deck gets to do, where it runs a creature with provoke and you can just shoot down fairies. And
I love decks that make use of super obscure old mechanics. It's so funny to me.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun to watch that deck work.
Yeah, Heroic is, it's the only deck in Pauper that even plays a card that has Provoke on it, let alone is able to abuse the mechanic, right?
Probably the only card in a lot of formats that does that.
I think Legacy Goblins, there's a red goblin with Provoke on it that's
probably
that's useful. I don't remember.
I'm sure there's something somewhere.
I don't know. All I remember is them dropping a Siege Gang on turn 2 off a Lackey, and then I lose.
Of course. Just Legacy fun times.
Yep.
We've sort of been seeing most of aggro be fairly stable. Heroic kind of faded off pretty quickly, and while Burn kind of had a heyday for a minute, it's sort of been seeing decreasing numbers with the meta shifts. I don't think Burn fares super well into a lot of the decks that have been floating around recently. Like, it doesn't do super well into Blue-Black Delver. It doesn't do super well into Dinrova Tron.
I mean, additionally, yeah, also, you know, when talking about Tron, right, like, you're playing Burn, right? I'm pretty sure Burn has an incredibly hard time of winning once the first Pulsa Marasa resolves, and then basically cannot win after the second one resolves.
That's sort of the thing, right, is you get to that point where it's just, yeah, I'm chipping in for one a turn, but he's casting Pulsa Marasa every turn. Like, there's just no coming back from that. Being able to be a deck that runs main deck life gain is really strong against Burn that way.
Yeah, the additional thing is some of the Tron decks even play Radiant Fountain, which is also really good against Burn. That was tech that was invented because of Burn. Burn and Stompy mainly back in, this is going way back now. I mean, Radiant Fountain is not new tech. Right.
No, that was sort of a post-Drake adaptation for a lot of decks.
Yeah, yeah. When Drake dissolved from the format, and, you know, these aggro decks started coming in droves now because, you know, Drake was gone, you know, ding-dong.
Because people had shifted over towards aggro decks to try and beat Drake, and then they just kept playing them. People were like, wait a minute, these are actually really good.
Yeah, yeah. And then people were like, hey, Radiant Fountain gains me life, and is a land drop, and I can flicker it, and I can get it back with Pulse. This is great.
And you can use it with your bounce lands.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's good. It's really good tech against these types of decks.
Is it just me, or are bounce lands in general just on a downshift in the meta?
I think people are kind of hesitant to play slow lands. Like, if you think about what a deck like Blue-Black Delver can put up in the first three turns, do you really want to have to mull away a hand that has a bounce land and an ETB tapped gain land?
Right. Yeah, no, it makes sense.
It's sort of like, yeah, this is a great hand, but I can't start playing Magic until turn three, and yeah. I'm probably going to be dead by that point.
Or right? at like, a point where I can't win.
Exactly. So I don't... I like those decks, and I like that older style of play, but at the same time, I can sort of understand where when your meta is predominantly things like Boros Bully and, you know, like, I don't want to be playing anything that slows me down. I don't want to be taking any time off my plays these days. Yeah, so that's basically the upshot of those decks. I kind of want to delve into sort of the ups and downs of Burn that have been kind of going on recently. It's one of those decks that's sort of seen a lot of changes in its main board play, because there was a long period of time where Burn was a Bolt-centric and Bolts-type decks. And then you had Shadows of Innistrad roll around, and we got...
Thermo Alchemist,
right? So then people were like, well, this basically makes all of my Bolts do 4 damage instead. Hypothetically, at least.
And now we can play Needle Drop, and as a double cantrip with we can play Needle Drop, right? Because it triggers the Alchemist. The one damage isn't that bad anymore, right? You know.
Yeah. So you sort of had this kind of trend towards that, and then it got reinforced when we got Firebrand Archer in Amonkhet. And being right. People were running these basically, suddenly Burn now has creatures, right? And it now has creatures it cares about not dying too, which is important.
Yep.
So sort of that plan going into Burn of, I can basically throw all my removal in the bin, starts to get a little bit more iffy, right? Like, how much removal do you side out? How much removal do you not care about? So you sort of had the shift away from that Bolt, Fire Blast type of deck, right? Towards more incremental damage. You had Curse of the Pierced Heart come in as well.
Yeah, slower, more controlled, methodical game plans out of the Burn decks, instead of just like, I'm going to bolt you till you're dead, hope you don't kill me before then, or, you know, whatever.
Yeah, trying to pull a little bit more reach out of the 75.
Yeah, which I think is a very good way for the deck to adapt. I mean... preferably, right? Burn doesn't want to be doing that, but this Pauper, we don't have access to all the other cards that Burn has access to in formats like Modern and Legacy, right? So, you know, we can't do what they do in Legacy, which is, you know, turn one, bolt you, turn two, Price of Progress you know, end of turn... Fire Blast you or whatever for just like all of your life, you know? Yeah, we don't have the crazy play patterns like that are present in those other formats, so you have to adapt from that point. You have to say, well, if I can't clock them, you know, if I can't consistently goldfish a turn three or four kill, right, then we have to change our strategy. We have to say, you know, can't kill on turn four, so what game plan can we shift to that still lends us to this heavy, fast aggro plan, but gives us a little bit more reach when it goes past turn four, right? And if we haven't killed them, that type of thing.
Yeah, and then Dominaria hit, and Burn got really weird for a while.
Yes.
Because in Dominaria, we got Gitu Lava Runner, which has been colloquially referred to as Bad Goblin Guide.
It's referred to actually as Garbage Guide.
Sorry, Garbage Guide.
Garbage Guide is the name. And let me tell you, it is gas in the 20 Cluestone deck.
I bet it's amazing in the 20 Cluestone deck.
Indeed.
So, Gitu Lava Runner reads, as long as there are two or more instants of sorcery cards in your graveyard, Gitu Lava Runner gets +1/+0. And it is a 1-mana 1/2. So, if you meet that clause, yeah, with haste.
Yeah, so if you go mountain, play it, mutagenic growth it, cast a gut shot, swing at you for 5, or I'm sorry, 4, yeah. Right?
That's sort of the deck that we started seeing popping up for a lot of players messing around with was how many Phyrexian mana spells can we put in a deck?
It turned into this really weird suicide red list which is crazy. So. No Immolating Soul Eater, though. That is the best Suicide Red card in any format.
Oh, I don't know, man.
Change my mind.
That's where you really hit the line. You know?
Oh, yeah, dude. No, that's the. It's Immolating Soul Eater is literally my favorite common. Fight me. Fight me, Amen. Joe.
There was a minute where people were like, Blitz is old news. We're going to run Immolating Soul Eater combo.
Yeah, I was part of the people that pushed that. I was posting that everywhere.
It was something.
Yeah, I mean, the card is incredible given the right amount of setup.
Yeah, I did lose a game one to that deck once.
What's that supposed to mean, Joe? I once lost a game one to that deck.
Just lose game two or three, that's what I'm saying.
Well, because you played Tordex, you goddamn monster.
No, I played Derovatron, obviously.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Anyways, so basically, Lava Runner turned the deck into something crazy for a few months while people tried to make it work as a turn one goblin guy. How do we get this to work in our format?
Yeah, and then they realized, hey, this doesn't really work that well. We're going to go back to the old lists.
Well, you say that, but the current versions of Burn have settled down into 4 Lava Runner, 4 Alchemist, and then a bunch of Burn spells, right?
Yeah.
So it's still in there, but they've kind of said, like, we're not going to do anything crazy to get this going, right? It exists, but...
They settled down and said, like, well, we're okay with this being a 1-2 some of the time. We don't need to go overboard with, you know, getting it to being a 2-2 on turn 1.
And it's back to how many versions of Bolt can we run. An interesting pickup that they've kind of started leaning into lately is Shard Volley as more ways to kill their lands and deal damage.
Yeah, it's interesting.
It's another Bolt. It's another Bolt, right?
Yeah. What more can you want? It's a Bolt, man. It's a Bolt. Bolt is Bolt.
So yeah, that's sort of the interesting development of Burn over the last not so while. But I would say it's really sunk quite a bit in the metagame. Like, it really doesn't put up the finishes it used to. It used to be a top player tier one in the metagame. I would say it's out of there pretty far now.
The issue there, yeah, I'd say it's sitting at like tier 1.5, 1.75, something
almost
around
tier
there.
Two. Yeah.
Yeah, almost tier two. The issue that happened is, like, sure, you had the little shakeup with the Lava Runner, but before that, the deck was pretty much solved. And usually what happens when a deck becomes solved, the way to sideboard against it also becomes solved, right? So all the decks in the format that Burn used to prey on started putting cards that were very good against Burn, like Soulcore Protection Red, and Feed the Clan, any life gain spells, you know, that are relevant. You know,
Hydro Blast getting downshift was a big kick for that deck.
Yeah, so, you know, once a deck becomes solved, the way to sideboard against it becomes solved as well, and you see all these decks that used to have bad Burn matchups now suddenly have great Burn matchups because they figured out how to sideboard correctly, and now the matchups that Burn used to have, you know, straight up free wins against are now a lot harder, and the matchups that it didn't have a good matchup with, it still doesn't have a good matchup with. So just overall, across the field, its win percentage has dropped against a lot of decks. So that's why we don't see it that much anymore. I mean, it's still a mainstay in the format. It's just definitely not as good as it used to be.
Burn will always be around. Stompy will always be around. Heroic will always be around. Delver will always be around. Mm-hmm. Right, but it doesn't mean they don't, you know, vary a little bit in their popularity.
Of course. Yeah, everything. Metas... A healthy meta should wax and wane, right? We don't want this to become, you know, a three-deck format like Standard.
Exactly. Another deck I've sort of seen doing that a little bit is Stompy recently. While the numbers have sort of stayed level, I've been hearing a lot of people talking about reverting more towards the Dead Dogs type of list, right? You know, going back to Wild Mongrel and Root Wallas and stuff like that.
Interesting.
There's a lot of people who've been finding the Elephant Guide package kind of a little bit iffy lately. It's a bit slow.
Yeah, I'm on board for Wild Mongrel bashing Root Wall. I mean, Root Wall is just he's our boy. It's one who would win in a fight, the best discard spell in all of Magic or one basking bully? It's the basking bully. He wins.
Yeah, so it's sort of interesting to see people tacking back towards older variants of that.
Yeah, absolutely.
That archetype, right? You know, see, I'd really like to see if, you know, people can get some actually good finishes with that version of it at this point,
yeah.
Or whether or not it's really is just not viable anymore.
Yeah, if it's just
somewhere else.
If it's just a test rather than, you know, an actual, you know, correct choice to do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd be pretty curious to see whether or not that pans out, or if Stompy goes in another direction. Like,
yeah.
There's a lot of very good green cards in the format, right, that would fit well into a Stompy list. So
yeah.
It would be kind of interesting to see if it finds some other path forward.
Oh, it could play Colossal Dreadmaw.
Colossal Dreadmaw, the Stompy tech of the future. Invest now in your copies of Colossal Dreadmaw.
All right. With that, I think we could call this episode to a close.
Yeah, I think that's about it for us today. Thanks for tuning into the cast today, everybody. Have a nice night.
Thanks for tuning into our royal decree on Colossal Dreadmaw.
Thanks for tuning into this week's episode of The Edict. If you have any questions or comments, you can direct them to our email, paupermtgdiscord@protonmail.com. Or use our website's contact form at castleofcommons.com. Good night, and remember to keep it common.